Bye.
I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The Centers for Disease Control reported that the teen birth rate in the United States has fallen over the past 20 years. In fact, it has declined by a whopping 57% to a historic low, which the CDC says has saved the country billions of dollars. It also means that more teenage girls are graduating from high school. So what explains this good news? We asked Bill Albert to join us. He's Chief Program Officer at the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. Joined us from an NPR studio in Washington, D.C. And Bill Albert, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you, Marty.
You're welcome. Has this been a slow and steady decline over the past couple of years or number of years, or something more precipitous than that?
Well, the starter's pistol goes off here in 1991. That was the peak of the teen birth rate. And it has, with the exception of 2 years, declined steadily and for every year since then. Now, it is also true that just at the time when you thought things might be leveling out or we might be regressing toward the mean, over the past 5 years or so, the decline has become really precipitous.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I think there are a number of things. If you look at the sort of 20-year plus decline, it really is this magic formula of less sex and more contraception. Teens are having fewer sexual partners. Some of them are delaying sex, and those who are having sex are using contraception a bit more consistently and carefully.
Does it also mean that the abortion rate among teenagers is also down?
Yes, the abortion rate among teens is down, in fact, and it is due to fewer teens getting pregnant in the first place. What we're seeing is fewer teen pregnancies, fewer teen abortions, and fewer teen births. All are heading in the right direction.
So is it the fact that sex ed classes, for instance, in school, that they're having some kind of effect?
Well, you know, I think it's a rich portfolio of different things. You know, I'd probably tick off four or five, which wouldn't explain it all. But I think there is some evidence to suggest that in recent years in particular, that the recession has helped stimulate some of these declines. Look, I know young people aren't checking their stock portfolio before they hop into the sack here, but they are keen observers of the world around them. And in the recent years with the economic downturn, I think that's had a sobering effect. There's also some evidence that really good, low-maintenance, highly effective contraception has played a role. More teens are using them. There's probably some sort of cycle of virtue here, a social norm that teen pregnancy is not okay, which I think has helped explain it. And of course, there has been a bigger investment from the federal government in proven sex education programs during the Obama administration, and that has played a role. The last factor I would add is MTV. I think that their reality programs on 16 and Pregnant and Teen Mom, watched by millions of teens, have also played a role.
Well, and I haven't seen those programs, but I have read about them. And is it because they are a reality of what it is to be a teen mom? One is called Teen Mom, the other called 16 and Pregnant, that has ended up being a cautionary tale for young people?
Yeah, young people describe it to us as far more sobering than salacious. We commissioned a survey a few years back, and what the essential bottom line was, for many teens who watch this show, they make the real challenges of early pregnancy and parenthood more real to them. You know, I think a shorthand way to describe it is sex education for the 21st century. These shows are tough. I think for people who might just sort of casually know about them and not watch them, they may seem somehow glamorizing. But if you watch just 10 minutes of any of these shows, you realize glamour is the last thing on any of these kids' minds.
Because we're talking about kids trying to, manage their baby or their young child, their life, perhaps trying to finish school, all these things that are the reality of having a kid.
Yeah, exactly right. Look, you know, parenthood, I'm not breaking any news here, is challenging for even the most stout among us. And if you think about, you know, a 16, 17-year-old young woman, often alone, without a partner, it really is quite challenging.
You talk about sex education classes, and I'm sure they run the gamut, but you feel as if they have been more effective in more recent years. What is the best, I guess, message or approach in reaching young people?
Well, the overwhelming evidence that we have right now is that those curricula that focus both on encouraging teens to delay sexual activity and that encourage teens strongly to use contraception if they're having sex tend to be the most effective. And, you know, that makes some common sense, particularly when you go back to this historic decline that we've seen in the nation. It really is this combination of less sex and more contraception, and those sex education programs that talk about those two things tend to be the most effective. Now, that's not the only thing they focus on. They're not just focused on body parts. They tend to talk about relationships and other things as well.
And what about abstinence only? Is that still a program idea that is being taught in schools?
There are many communities that do, in fact, use so-called abstinence-only programs. What has changed over the past several years is that the federal government's investment in abstinence-only has almost all gone away. And instead, rather than sort of ideology or content, they have focused on programs that have been shown through careful evaluation to actually change teen behavior.
Are you telling us that abstinence-only does not work?
I think we have right now of a list of somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 programs that have been shown, again, through careful independent evaluation to change teen behavior. One of those programs is an abstinence-only program. The 34 others are not.
Oh, interesting. You talk about the various forms of birth control. Are young people largely using condoms? Are they using the pill? What forms of birth control are they using?
Yeah, you're quite right. The two most commonly used forms of birth control among teens are the condom and the birth control pill. However, I think it's important to note in recent years, as I noted earlier, that there has been an uptick in teens' use of so-called LARC methods, long-acting reversible contraception. I like to call it low-maintenance methods of birth control that don't require daily attention or a game-time decision. Now, it is true that teen use of these highly effective methods, it's still relatively small. However, it is on the way up, and I think helps explain in part the steep decreases we've seen over the past 5 years.
Are you referring to things like IUDs or implants?
Yes, exactly right. IUD and implant.
And the idea is what, they are more effective because once they're there, so to speak, you don't have to make the decision every time.
Exactly. It's a sort of set it and forget it. You know, some of these are effective for multiple years. And we know that teens are, as a general matter, not very good at using contraception. Neither are adults, for that matter. Teens are not different than we adults are. So this sort of takes some of the fog out of using contraception. You have a professional, medical professional insert it, and it's effective nearly 99% of the time for any number of years.
I was reading about it. I think it's the state of Colorado has actually been giving away free IUDs and allowing teenagers to have access to this form of contraception. How effective has that been?
The program in Colorado, run by the Colorado Family Planning Initiative, has been remarkably successful. And it as you describe, they made in the 68 clinics around the state about 30,000 IUDs available at no cost or low cost to women who wanted them. And the teen birth rate, the teen pregnancy rate, the unintended pregnancy rate has all declined quite remarkably. And the findings in Colorado, I should note, mirror closely another program that was run, the Contraceptive Choice Project in St. Louis. Same sort of thing. They offered contraception at free or low cost. There was good counseling. And the uptake in IUDs and implants, again, these highly effective, low-maintenance methods of birth control, were quite staggering. And the results speak for themselves. There really have been remarkable declines in both Colorado and in around St. Louis.
We've been talking for 10 minutes, and we haven't said the word parents. What role do you think parents play?
Well, I love talking about parents because it is still, to this day, counterintuitive. One of the most consistent things we have found over the two decades that we've been at this at the National Campaign is just how influential parents can be and how reluctant they are to believe it. You know, it's quite interesting. Teens tell us time and time again in survey after survey that it is parents, not peers, not practitioners, not even popular culture, but parents that most influence their decisions about sex. And I think that's quite surprising for a lot of parents. They essentially look at the teen sexual culture as no more than a blur of bare midriffs. And so this is really sort of news to them each time we talk to them. And it's surprising, I guess, in a way. You know, we don't have to convince parents, do we, that they're influential when it comes to their kids' educational attainment or, I don't know, what food they eat, etc. But we still need to convince parents that when it comes to their kids' decisions about relationships, sex, contraception, when and under what circumstances to start a family, that parents really do have a role to play.
Is it that parents don't know how to talk about it or they don't want to talk about it? It feels like a taboo in some way?
You know, I think there are several factors going on. Number one, I think there's a small proportion of parents who still think in this day and age that if they talk about sex or talk about contraception with their kids, that they are somehow introducing the topic to their kids or tacitly giving them approval. We know that's not the case.
Kids know about sex, you're telling us.
That's right. Okay. I mean, maybe that was true at the turn of the century. It is not anymore. Needless to say. It is also true that, you know, this can be uncomfortable for many parents. And they freely tell us that even those parents who know they should be talking to their kids say they don't know what to say or when to say it. So I think there's a lot going on there. But, you know, the most important message for parents, though, is to convince them that they matter. We can help them with the words, we can help them with the discussions, but they're not going to do any of these things unless they believe in their soul that they really are going to make a difference.
We're almost up in a break here, but I wonder, you know, if parents were to watch Teen Mom and 16 and Pregnant with their children, maybe that's an opportunity to have this discussion.
I appreciate you saying that. You know, the content that teenagers consume, and the last data I saw that if you look at young people age 8 to 18, they consume about 44 hours of media every single week.
44 in a week?
44 hours in a week.
Wow.
That's needless to say, that's more than they're in school. So the media is a great way to sit down with your kids and to talk about issues that can be challenging. And, you know, even if the message that you're seeing on your television is not exactly the one you want, that's okay. You can talk to your son or your daughter and say, gee, how do you think about the reaction of the character?
And that's Bill Albert, our first guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's Chief Program Officer at the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. We are talking about the fact that teenage pregnancy rates have been dropping over the last two decades. We want to hear from you. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
BRE Presents supports WHYY and welcomes Pink Martini to the Keswick Theater September 19th. Also at the Keswick, a classical pop crossover with two cellos April 25th. Tickets at the Keswick box office and BREPresents.com.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi. Vancouver supergroup The New Pornographers stopped by Studio Q to perform from their propulsive new pop record, Brill Bruisers, plus filmmaker Gabe Polsky on his documentary, The Red Army. That's coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Edith Stern lived in a Nazi concentration camp as a young woman. Now she lives in a retirement home in Chicago that caters to the last generation of Holocaust survivors.
They also came from Europe. They also suffered. And we had very much in common. And I felt I was at home.
That story next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
JPMorgan Chase and Stepping Stone Scholars, a Philadelphia nonprofit dedicated to preparing underserved students for academic success, support WHYY. The Step Into Fall Gala will be September 20th at the new Dilworth Park. For tickets, steppingstonescholars.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Bill Albert about a good news story that hasn't gotten much attention. The pregnancy and birth rates for teenagers have been dropping steadily over the last two decades. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Bill, in fact, we have a tweet from Ron. He says, your guest mentioned moral virtue, but only mentions MTV. There are community and religious organizations that have been helping with this, too. Can you speak to that?
Well, your listener is exactly right. There have been a substantial amount of civic action in leadership among churches, religious groups, and others on this issue in many states and at the national level, too. And it undoubtedly has played a role. There's no question about that.
We've been focusing on pregnancy and birth rates. Is it also possibly true that teenagers are having, I guess, what I would call non-vaginal sex? I mean, the kind of sex you have where you don't get pregnant?
Yes, I mean, we don't have the best measures of that behavior, but I don't think we should sort of overstate it. You know, to use a terrible phrase from social science, these things tend to co-occur. I think we should just understand that teenagers are seeing sort of how challenging it can be in this day and age and in this economy to start a family when you're quite young, and I think they're making good decisions.
When you say then teenagers are having less sex, you mean less all kinds of diverse kinds of sex?
Yeah, again, we don't have the best measures to look at all kinds of sex. You know, we're focused on pregnancy and births, and so we're looking at sexual intercourse primarily. And if you look at that, particularly among teen boys, that has declined pretty substantially since the early 1990s.
The CDC, in talking about this decline, talks about the fact that the country has saved billions of dollars and also that it's more likely that teenage girls are going to graduate from high school if they don't have a child. Can you flesh that out? And also, we should talk about teenage boys as well.
Yeah, well, if you look at education, I think that's a great thing to focus on. The last data that we have seen on this, last good data, suggests that only about 40%, not quite 40%, of young women who get pregnant and have a child in high school ever go on to graduate high school, let alone go on to seek any sort of secondary education. So again, I think in this day and age and in this economy, that really is quite sobering. And I think many teens recognize that. I mean, I think we also have to apply a common sense, not a research lens here, but a common sense lens. You know, if you think back to the time, you know, when you were 16, 17 years old, the thought of starting a family at that time is really quite challenging. And it's no wonder that so many young women have difficulty completing their education under those circumstances. To your second point, you know, you were quite right. This is why, even with the historic declines in teen pregnancy and births, that we ought not to mistake progress for victory. As you noted, there are public costs associated here. We estimated at about $11 billion annually.
$11 billion, just the cost. I guess because if a teenage girl has a baby, she's not going to finish high school, chances are she's going to need some kind of government support. So I'm thinking all the various scenarios that can happen because of this.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, if you play this out, there are education costs, lost revenue costs, there are health costs, Medicaid costs. You pile those all together and sum them up, and our conservative estimate is about $11 billion a year. Uh-huh. Now, that's less than it was. You know, the glass half full interpretation here is that, you know, the declines in teen births, which we've been discussing, have really lowered the cost since we started estimating this.
This clearly is progress and clearly is good news, but it's interesting to compare these now reduced rates to other countries. For instance, in Russia, UK, Japan, Denmark, less than 5%. So while this is good news, the U.S. has a long way to go to reduce teenage parenthood.
Yeah, you're quite right. The teen birth rate in this country remains staggeringly high by international standards. Just to sort of give you a rough estimate, our rates here in the U.S., again, taking into account the historic declines, mm-hmm. are more than four times higher than the rate for Western Europe, and even surpass the rates for many countries in Eastern Europe.
So where do we go from here?
Well, again, I think there needs to be this fundamental recognition that we have done, thanks to teenagers, by the way, an extraordinary job in this country. We have made historic progress on an issue I think many people once considered intractable. Full stop. We also have to recognize that despite these declines, our rates remain quite high, and that, you know, what goes down can go back up again. It's not as if we have developed some sort of vaccine for teen pregnancy. So we have to keep at this here. Again, not to mistake progress for victory. I think we need to keep parents involved in particular.
And keep parents involved in particular, but also keep at all the things that we have been talking about in terms of education and access to contraception, all of that.
That's right. It's not a simple solution. When we look at why the rates have gone down, we listed, five or six factors, and there are probably 10 more we could discuss. We have to keep pressing forward on all of those fronts.
Well, Bill Albert, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for the discussion.
You're welcome. And he's Chief Program Officer at the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. And we've been talking about the fact that the Centers for Disease Control reported that the teen birth rate in the United States took a pretty dramatic fall over the past 20 years, declining something like 57%, a historic low. And as we have been talking about, that drop has saved the country billions of dollars, and it also means that teenage girls are more likely to graduate from high school. Well, the female condom has been called many things over the years: a jellyfish, a windsock, a plastic freezer bag, something designed for a female elephant, and those are all quotes. Well, the Gates Foundation has awarded grants for the, quote, next generation condom, and our guest, Debbie Herbenick, is one of the recipients. She is Associate Director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University, also a sexual health educator at the Kinsey Institute, and joins us once again on Radio Times. Nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good to have you here. So why do we need a female condom?
Why don't we need a female condom? You know, we need male condoms, female condoms. We need all the possibilities we can have that are safe and effective, so that people can have, you know, safer experiences of sex and plan their families.
Has it been hard, though, to design and produce an essentially a female condom? Is there something about the female anatomy that's made it challenging?
It is challenging, and it's a process we're going through right now to prototype them. So the grant that we were very fortunate to receive from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation goes toward the development of this condom. So that really is starting from scratch from our design and moving it forward. So my partner in this project, Frank, has been going and traveling through Thailand and Malaysia to start working on those initial stages. And, you know, the challenge is that, you know, the vagina is very different than the penis. So when you're thinking about a female condom and keeping it in place during sex, that's very different than putting, for example, a male condom over a penis and keeping that in place, which is done through, you know, sort of like this very elastic base at the bottom. So the measurements that you have to go through, the issues of kind of like, you know, the testing, what makes it safe, what keeps it in place, are all sort of different for the female condom than they are for the male condom, and that's been a challenge.
Yours is called the female pleasure condom.
It is, because we think that, you know, pleasure has been missing from the conversation with female condoms, and we think that those features of design are important. They were part of the Gates Foundation call-out, really specifically asked for male and female condom designs that were attentive to pleasure, and we took that challenge seriously. So we did include design elements that we hope will make sex feel better for the women and men using our female condom.
So what are those designs?
Well, for one, I mean, we've tried to make it shaped better for a woman's anatomy than previous female condoms. Just as you started, you know, it is true that people have used phrases like it's like a sandwich bag or a freezer bag to describe old ones. And that doesn't feel good to people, doesn't feel sexy to think about using a product like that. And, you know, that's not to knock the existing products. I think it's been really innovative that they're even on the market and people have really worked very hard to come up with good products. It's just that we're at an earlier stage of innovation with female condoms than we are with male. And so, you know, I think all of the ones, you know, that are in the works now, including ours, are trying to be more attentive to how women's bodies are actually built. And then we're also including different forms of texturing in areas of the vagina known to be kind of erotically sensitive, like the front wall of the vagina, and other elements of the shape of the entryway that we hope, again, for women and their partners will make it a more pleasurable condom to use.
Do you think condom is a problematic word when trying to develop something that, as you say, includes pleasure besides protection?
You know, it is the word, and it's, you know, it's a medical device, and, you know, and it's fine. I think we just have a long way to go. I think most people, when they hear female condom, can't wrap their minds around that, you know, because to us, yeah, the word condom generally means a male condom that's worn on a man's body. And so I actually think that's one of the biggest challenges. I'm hoping that, you know, by us calling our condom the female pleasure condom, that at least we're, you know, getting through to some people that there may be something here that's positive. And really, I think, you know, for younger generations, we're being helped enormously by a male condom industry that has done phenomenal work. You know, we have so many male condoms now that really are attentive to issues of pleasure. So I think I teach college students here at Indiana University, and many of my college students really do choose condoms specifically for pleasure elements and pleasure parts of the design. And that's different than a lot of us who are quite a bit older, and maybe we remember, you know, earlier generations of condoms where there wasn't a lot of variety. They weren't very fun. And so I'm hoping that some of those perceptions of condoms are changing with time.
Does a female condom also give a woman then more control over protection and perhaps even pleasure when having sex with another person?
Yeah, that's the idea. And so, you know, we do hope that female condoms are a real viable alternative for many women. And that was the power of them when they first came out. And it's the power we're hoping to run with, too, because women all over the world, you know, really do still struggle with equitable power in their relationships. And many women want to insist on using a condom during sex, whether to reduce the risk of infections or to avoid or delay becoming pregnant at that time in their lives. And too often, their male partners just don't want to use a condom and you know, say it's uncomfortable for them and so on. And at least having a female condom gives women an option to say, well, then I'll wear one. And, you know, if that condom also happens to feel good for her and her partner, then that's hopefully a bonus and will make it an even easier negotiation.
Are female condoms inserted, hours, for instance, before having sex?
Yeah, female condoms can be inserted hours before sex. I don't have any sense that that's done too often, but they certainly can be, because unlike a male condom, you don't have to wait, you know, for the body to change to put one on. So that's possible. But I think for the most part, people are putting them on, you know, shortly before sex starts.
You mentioned the fact that your partner is in India. Does that mean this condom that you've been working on, it does exist and it's now in the testing phase?
No, so Frank is in actually Malaysia and Thailand working on the development of the condom. Once we get the real condom and enough samples to go through a few trials here in the U.S. first, then we are hoping to extend the research into India, absolutely.
And how competitive is it to develop a female condom?
Well, I would say it's more challenging than competitive. I mean, there certainly is a great market out there for male and female condoms, and we'll deal with those competition issues as they arise. But I think customers just deserve a lot of choice out there. But it's challenging. Yeah. But it's exciting and fun. And, you know, for someone like me who does a lot of research and education, the idea of possibly making, you know, this tangible thing that can fit into people's lives and hopefully save some lives and help people plan pregnancies is really exciting.
How do you, I was talking earlier with Bill Albert talking about this new study, or actually the results of what looks like a long-term decline in teenage pregnancy and childbirth. We were talking about the difference between condoms and pills and things like IUDs. How do you see condoms fitting into those various choices?
Well, you know, condoms are incredibly important because male and female condoms remain the only devices that we have to protect against sexually transmitted infections, including HIV. And so that doesn't mean we don't have excellent forms of birth control. We do, and I think that they both play an important role in people's sexual lives and in their health. And so a challenge is that, you know, as many young people move from for example, sometimes using condoms predominantly when they're teenagers or, you know, 18, 19, 20, they move from that into often hormonal forms of birth control that are very effective at protecting against pregnancy. But sometimes people's relationships aren't ready for that exact switch. And I think what we need to be seeing more of is people actually using both types of contraceptives, because hormonal birth control has an excellent role to play. They're, you know, highly effective, and you can, you know, use them all the time, for example, taking pills every day to avoid becoming pregnant. But you need a condom to protect against STIs or HIV. And I'm very sadly and actually scarily in the last year, I've noticed many of my college students say that they didn't realize before taking my human sexuality class that condoms protected against STIs and HIV. Wow. And that scares me. I didn't used to hear that as often. In the last year, I've heard that from so many of my students. So I think, unfortunately, some of the changes we've seen in the way that public health folks around the country have been talking about safer sex has been almost exclusively focused on pregnancy, and we certainly needed to reduce those rates, but we can't lose sight of the conversation about STIs either.
Well, I was reading about STIs, and HPV is the most common in this country?
Yes, HPV is very common among women and men of all ages.
Women and men?
Yes.
Just because of the nature of the virus?
Yeah, and most people wouldn't know that they have it, and there's not readily available testing for men. So most men who believe that they've been tested for quote-unquote everything have never been tested for HPV, because it's just kind of not around. Now we do have HPV vaccines available for both women and men, and hopefully over time that will change. You know, the good news about HPV is that most people don't suffer serious consequences from it. And so most people's bodies seem to be able to handle the infection. Most people don't even realize that they have it. But there are, you know, that's not to say that there aren't some serious problems that do result from it. There are, you know, there are HPV-related cancers in several sites of the body.
About a minute before our break here, we have a Facebook comment from Lisa. Where can you buy a female condom, and how much do they cost?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there are a few cities, Chicago is one of them, for example, that have really had targeted campaigns around the female condom, and they're more widely available. But for the most part, people are buying them on the internet, sometimes certain family planning clinics or college clinics. But most drugstores in the U.S. don't carry them, and that's one of the challenges in the U.S. about getting them out to people. They can be comparable in price to male condoms, or sometimes a little bit more.
A little bit more. Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about the female condom. We're talking about sexuality, sex health education. And again, our guest is Debbie Herbenick, and she's Associate Director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University. She and her partner are working on developing a female condom they have called the Female Pleasure Condom. And she's Associate Director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University, as I said, a sexual health educator at the Kinsey Institute. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Questions or comments, do give us a call. Send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Fringe Art supports WHYY. The actual NASA-recorded sound of a deep space black hole can be heard when Fringe Arts presents The Four Seasons Restaurant, an unflinching drama by Italy's renowned director Romeo Castellucci. Compelling soundscapes and awe-inspiring visuals propel this theatrical look at the impact of absence on the human psyche. Presented now as part of the 2014 Fringe Festival. More at fringearts.com. That's fringearts.com.
Fresh Air's book critic Maureen Corrigan has just written a book about the novel she loves more than any other. The novel she and many other critics consider the greatest American novel, The Great Gatsby. In writing about Gatsby, she also writes about herself as a reader and teacher. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Maureen about her new book, So We Read On. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
It's a universal dream living in a supportive, positive family environment. But creating thriving family relationships takes much more than patience, effort, and time. On this Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, real families, real issues, and real solutions. Dr. Gottlieb and CFR therapist Dr. Steve Treat take callers' questions on family dynamics, from post-divorce parenting to aging parents and anything in between. Today at noon on WHYY FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Don't be shy. You can join our conversation. We've been talking about the female condom, sexuality education, sexual health. And again, our guest is Debbie Herbenick. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Debbie, we began by talking about this pretty dramatic and important decline in teenage pregnancy and also in teenage births. And I'd just be curious, as someone who knows so much about what people do and certainly about sexuality, what do you make of this decline? And it's been over a 20-year period.
Yeah, you know, it's a wonderful decline. Obviously, we're all happy about it. I think, you know, there's no single cause of why we're seeing fewer teen pregnancies than we used to. You know, some of it may be greater access to birth control, a wider range of more effective birth controls, even, you know, 10, 11 years ago, we first had things like the birth control patch and ring come out. So for people that didn't want to take pills, that was a good option. And we have had a lot more emphasis, as I mentioned earlier, on things like condoms and their role in preventing pregnancy and not just STIs. I still think we need to keep the focus, you know, to include a focus on STIs. But, right. You know, but we have had so many wonderful efforts, you know, across a range of, you know, sort of medical technologies and education to try to help that decline along. And it's encouraging. We still have a long ways to go, but it is encouraging.
Well, Bill Albert, who was our guest, he said he couldn't answer this question, but I'll put it to you because you have studied the kind of diversity of sexual behavior. Would it be fair, you think, to think that perhaps teens are not having vaginal intercourse, and that might explain? I mean, they might be having sex, but it doesn't have to do with vaginal intercourse.
Well, you know, they're doing all kinds of things. And some of our research has looked at sexual behavior of Americans ages 14 through, you know, mid-90s or so. And so we do have a number, we do have a lot of data on 14 to 17-year-olds and what they do sexually. And it is true that, you know, they engage in oral sex and very smaller percentages in anal sex. But we still have a sizable number engaging in vaginal intercourse. However, their reports of condom use are so much higher than any other age group. And that's not just because they're, you know, certainly not trying to become pregnant for the most part and all of that. But, you know, I still think that we're doing a better job educating teenagers that condom use is important if you want to protect yourself against pregnancy and infections. Because even adults much older, if they're having sex with people they don't know very well, like a new casual partner, they're still very unlikely to use condoms. And at least teens are using condoms much of the time.
Is that because that's just been a message they have gotten pretty consistently over the years?
You know, I think it is. I mean, I grew up in the 90s in Miami, Florida, and, you know, the HIV epidemic was raging. And I certainly remember my friends and I always hearing that message, you know, years before we even thought about having sex. And I imagine that is still the case now, that there's just this sense of, you know, if or when we have sex, we need to use a condom. Unfortunately, I get the sense from our data that that window is very short. Huh. And so, you know, you see these very high rates of condom use for that 14 to 17-year-old age group, and then they decline for the 18 to 19-year-olds and decline even more, like really, really dramatically after that. So when I talk with my college students in my human sexuality class, that's something that we spend some time discussing, because most of them also don't want to become pregnant right right now in their lives, and they do want to not become infected, and yet they do experience those things all the time because many of them are not using condoms in addition to whatever other method of birth control that they may use.
I know part of sexuality education does include delaying sex. What do you think, though, about abstinence-only programs? And I don't know how many there are, but I'd be curious about whether you've looked at their effectiveness.
You know, that's not been an area of my specific research. Others have. And, you know, a challenge is that there are so many kinds of programs out there. So there, even under the abstinence-only umbrella, there's many different ways that people do that. Under abstinence until marriage, which is different than abstinence-only, then those are, you know, those there's a wide number there, too. And same with comprehensive sex education. So there's so many different kinds of each variety. And some colleagues who did a study quite a few years ago now on this topic, 5, 6, 7 years ago, they actually found that one of the challenges is that even when they asked teachers in the school systems where these programs were being held, that sometimes the teachers didn't know what to call them. You know, were they abstinence-only? Were they abstinence-based? Were they comprehensive? They weren't always sure. So it's a challenge. But what we do know is that, you know, the better programs are what we would consider more comprehensive sexuality education. They're teaching about communication. They're teaching about kind of articulating your values. They're teaching you how to be assertive around sexuality, as well as topics like sexually transmitted infections and birth control, sexual orientation, and a range of other topics in the full spectrum of sexuality.
Let me quickly reintroduce you, and then I do want to get some callers in the conversation. That's Debbie Herbenick, and she is an associate director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University. She and her partner are developing a female condom. She's also a sexual health educator at the Kinsey Institute. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Deborah from, looks like Temple University, to join our conversation. Deborah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually work with women in North Philadelphia, and we have a project. We were trying to understand factors that were contributing to unintended pregnancy. And what we found is that, in fact, young women are having less sexual partners, and they are reporting using contraception, including the male condom. But what we did find is that lots of women are not using that type of contraception consistently.
Yeah.
So we were looking at trying to understand factors that are involved with inconsistent contraception use among women in Philadelphia. We actually found that women that are not consistently using contraception have high levels of depressive symptoms, have low sexual self-efficacy, and have poor negotiation skills with their sexual partner. So I wonder if the guest could sort of comment on some of the programs that are out there to try to train or give young women the skills they need to negotiate contraception with a sexual partner.
Deborah, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Debbie, you want to take that?
Yeah, what a wonderful question.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of our big challenges is that so much of the sex education that does happen for young women and men happens almost before they need it. Now, that doesn't mean it shouldn't be there, like in 9th and 10th grade. It should. But too many high schools, for example, don't do anything after that. And so it's not relevant to everyone in 9th or 10th grade. It doesn't feel relevant to every student. I still think it belongs there because it's relevant to many. But what we have is many students who start becoming sexually active in 11th grade or 12th grade, or when they're freshmen in college or shortly after graduating high school. And for those students, we're really missing an opportunity not only to educate them about condoms and birth control, but also exactly what Deborah, our caller from Temple is talking about, these negotiation skills. You know, how do you stand up for yourself? How do you insist on condom use? How do you feel good enough about yourself that if somebody says, well, then, you know, I'm not going to use a condom and I'm not going to have sex with you, you say then, okay, that's fine. You know, we're not having sex then. But those are, you know, that really takes a sense of, you know, your own self-worth and value. And it also takes really strong communication skills, especially for young women, that unfortunately we just don't do enough of, and we don't do it enough over the long term. They often occur almost in these like single shot doses as if they were vaccines. And then you don't need another one for 10 or 15 years. And that's not the way that you learn to interact. You know, that's fine for medicine, but it's not fine for education.
Well, and Deborah also seemed to indicate that for a number of these women, they are dealing with things like depression or perhaps anxiety. So that just sort of exacerbates whatever negotiation is going on.
It absolutely can. And it can make you, you know, when you're feeling sad or you're feeling depressed, that can make it particularly difficult to really stand up for yourself or to feel like you matter enough to protect yourself. And also, we sometimes just need to feel closer to someone when we're feeling sad. And that can mean ditching contraceptives, unfortunately.
And not to do an ad for your female condom, but if a woman has her own condom, does that, using Debbie's example, give her then more control over, again, this interaction?
Yeah, hopefully it would, but she does still have to feel like she matters enough to say, you know, I have my own condom, you know, mm-hmm. I'll use this, and to kind of convince her partner that's okay. So we need good technology, we need good contraceptives, but we also really need to keep working with people so that they develop the skills to communicate in the way that keeps them safe.
What role do you think parents have, and I put this to our first guest as well, in term, if we're talking about teenagers or perhaps even, you know, couples communicating with each other, what role does communication have? And if it is parents talking to children or talking to teenagers, what advice do you have?
To have an ongoing conversation, to not just try to have the talk. That's a common thing that we sex educators say is, you know, keep it an ongoing conversation. But it's true because, you know, there are so many things that come up over a child or a teenager or a young adult's life. And they have different needs at different times in life. You know, they at one point they may need to understand what a period is or what tampons or pads are for. And at another point where babies come from. And then, you know, how to tell if someone likes you, how to ask somebody out. Lately I've been spending a lot of time thinking about how I'm not sure how often parents really talk with their teenagers or their adult children who are like 20, 24 about the meaning of sexual intimacy and the value in creating something that feels right to them. I have so many college students who, engage in sex that doesn't really feel right to them. And they know it at this gut level, but they don't necessarily know that they should be expecting anything different or how to create that something different. And so I think, whether it's about keeping yourself safe from STIs or delaying or avoiding pregnancy or just creating a meaningful relationship with somebody, I think we need to have more parents participating in that conversation with their kids, even though it's uncomfortable. You know, it's not comfortable for parents, it's not comfortable for kids, but it gets better with time, just like it does between new partners. It's really awkward when you're in a new relationship to talk about sex for many people, but the more you do it, it becomes more comfortable.
Let me get, looks like Mary Ann from Coopersburg, Pennsylvania, to join us. Hi, Mary Ann. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I'm calling just in terms of the dialogue about sex education and parents' conversations with their kids related to sex. The culture that we live in seems to be an almost alarming rate of rapes, particularly in these young kids where the female is impaired to beyond the point of being able to give consent. And it seems like that often is neglected in terms of educating our boys and having that conversation with the boys about consent and what's okay and what's not. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Marian, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Debbie Herbenick, what do you say?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and I think that also has to start young. You know, that really, I years ago, I used to work a lot in preschools and kindergartens, and, you know, we all know with children those age, one of the important lessons you teach is, you know, hands to yourself and respecting other people's property and those basic lessons that have to start young. But we also have to have these conversations with teenagers and with people who are, you know, 18, 20, 24, and older, but about just being a decent human being. and not only about not being the one to do something awful to somebody else, like have sex with them when they're not conscious or they can barely consent or not consent at all, but also about, you know, one of the things I talk to my students about is that, you know, if you hear your friends joke about this or say things that they're going to get somebody really drunk tonight to have sex, you know, call them on it. Watch out when that person's at the party. But it really is about being a decent human being who is caring about other people. And most people are, but sometimes they just need a little nudge in the right direction that it's okay to stand up for what you think is right, even if that means having a very awkward or even possibly, you know, challenging or aggressive confrontation with another male friend who's doing something that you think is wrong or that could hurt somebody else. But I'm glad I'm glad the caller brought that up, because it's becoming a good cultural conversation thanks to the White House's emphasis on sexual assault on campuses. But this needs to be a much broader conversation, and it has to start in families and homes, and it has to be in schools. And this is not just about college campuses, but also about middle schools and high schools too.
Do you think the country is making progress when it comes to the sort of overall issue of sexuality and health?
Definitely not with sexual assault issues, I don't think so. I mean, this is a step in the right direction with the White House call, but we have got enormous, enormous gains that we still have to make. My college students really are suffering. I mean, that's not an understatement. They are suffering, and I know they are sick and tired of this happening to them, and I'm sick and tired of hearing my students talk about this every semester, what happens. And this is not unique to my campus. It's campuses all over the world. It's not an American problem either. And so we've got a long way to go for sexuality education for young people, but for adults also. You know, it's not right that people are kind of stranded for sexuality information after they leave 9th or 10th grade. I certainly hear from many people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s who could use, you know, some information and advice later on, too. So we're getting there by baby steps, but I think it's about time we start taking some bigger steps.
You mentioned the fact, we're almost out of time here, that you worked in kindergartens on sexuality and sex education.
No. Okay. Before I got into sex research, I actually was much more interested in child development.
Oh, is that right?
And, yeah. And so, but all those issues came up. That wasn't my focus at the time. But man, parents were dealing with those, you know, back then, just as they are now, too. So I still do talks for local parents groups about, you know, how to talk to your kids about, you know, the many questions that they have as they grow up.
Well, on that note, Debbie Herbenick, thanks so much for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And she's sexual health educator at the Kinsey Institute, also associate director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion, and that's at Indiana University. And she and her partner are working on a female condom. She's also the author of several books, including Sex Made Easy and Because It Feels Good, A Woman's Guide to Sexual Pleasure and Satisfaction. We began our conversation with Bill Albert, chief program officer at the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of the show. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.